KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to the inaugural for this quarter edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. I'm very excited to have on the show today the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at the Center for Internet Society, or CIS for short, Ryan Calo. Ryan joined CIS, I think, right after I left, or soon thereafter, if memory serves. But Ryan's been with CIS for a few years and is doing a lot of interesting work, not only in the privacy area, but in other areas that we'll be talking about during the show. The focus of today's show is an article that Ryan authored that came out last year in Indiana Law Review called The Boundaries of Privacy Harm. And this is an article that is worthy of some extended discussion. In this article, Ryan identifies the boundaries of, as the title suggests, of what we mean by a privacy violation. And this may sound on the surface like an academic discussion, but it has, although it has academic elements to it in terms of what we might perceive as theory, it has very practical implications as we think about what is and is not a privacy violation. And part of the focus of the article is, and part of the genesis of the article, I think, and we'll talk about this as well, is that privacy violations, or I have a right to privacy, these kinds of phrases are used heavily. And they're used so much that I think, and I think Ryan's paper suggests, that they start, the phrases themselves and the term privacy starts to have a blurry meaning, or the meaning itself is diffused. And the result is that we don't really know what we're talking about when we say that there is a privacy issue. So in this article, Ryan goes through a variety of scenarios that might be considered or might not be considered privacy violations, and goes into a further discussion of what he calls subjective and objective harms. So there's a lot of meat here. There's a lot of stuff to talk about, and I'm excited to have that conversation with Ryan. In addition, we're going to talk a bit about what CIS is up to now and some projects that are coming up in the future. But without any further discussion and introduction, Ryan, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me.
Ryan is joining us by Skype from his office at Stanford. Ryan, let's start off with a fundamental question. And normally I would start with who you are, but we'll get to that in a moment. How about a broader question? For those that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, they're familiar with CIS, but perhaps you could talk about CIS as it's constituted today. What's the structure and who's there, and broadly what's going on?
Oh, yeah, I'd love to. So as people likely know, CIS was founded about a decade ago by Larry Lessig. The current faculty director is Barbara Venshevic, who is one of the foremost authorities on net neutrality, and trained both as a lawyer and as a computer scientist. So we actually have about four core areas that we work on. One is the Fair Use Project, and that is headed up by Tony Falzone and Julie Ahrens. And the goal there is to defend and expand the right of fair use and copyright. And so in connection, we defend individuals who have used copyrighted materials. And also we have a documentary review program where our staff reviews documentaries and tries to assess whether a given clip is fair use. And if it goes through our process, it makes it easier for the documentary to get lower rates of insurance and to find representation. And so it's a way for documentaries, which often use a lot of copyrighted material, to get out there that might otherwise find that prohibitively expensive. Then there is Barbara's work, which is on the relationship between architecture and public policy. And she is, again, someone participating quite closely in the FCC proceedings around net neutrality and European and other international proceedings. There is the Consumer Privacy Project, which is what I direct, And we basically, through research and through building tools, proofs of concept especially, we try to enhance consumer privacy. So for example, we have a project now called privacons.org, and it's a collaboration between the center and an international regulator, a professional designer, a policy person at Google, Europe, and some students. And basically the goal is, you know how like, you know, everybody has a horror story about a time that they replied all or forwarded something
right.
that they shouldn't have. And, you know, in this technology, email has been around for a long, long time. There's a sense in which email is a sort of lowest hanging privacy fruit that there is. And so what we've made is a plugin that allows you to affix an icon to your email to indicate your preferences with how it's used. So this is sort of Jonathan Zittrain's idea of code back norms, and something that Lauren Gelman explores in her article on blurry edge social networks. The idea is to be able to signal to people, you know, okay to read, but don't forward, internal use only, don't print, in a common vocabulary, which has certain resemblances to Creative Commons, but obviously the purpose here is not to assert or reduce your legal rights, but rather to signal to other people and remind them to be more careful, or you know, and there are also icons that promote sharing. So we do a lot of things like that, and we do you know, research on how design affects perceptions, which we may talk about today. All kinds of different projects, research and you know, for lack of a better word, code-based projects to enhance consumer privacy. And then finally, we're beginning to look at autonomous systems and robotics and artificial intelligence as a core focus area, but that is one that's still emerging. So you know, who we are, we're seven or eight staff and academics who work on in the intersection of technology and law and policy.
And we're going to talk about some of those projects that you referred to at the end there, towards the end of the show. One additional follow-up question on CIS. For people that are listening closely, they heard me introduce myself as an affiliate scholar, where up to now, and for quite a while, I've introduced myself as a non-resident fellow, and before that as a resident fellow. Perhaps you could describe this new delineation that exists now at CIS.
Absolutely. So we have an incredibly rich network of affiliates, and basically they fall into a couple of different categories. And there's not too many. There are not terribly a lot of them. I mean, you know, there's only a dozen or so in all. And basically these are people that we've identified as having these interesting projects that are relevant to what ongoing CIS concerns. And so the different categories are, one, affiliate scholar, and this is a person who is a professor, like yourself, who is working on scholarship and has a project that forms the basis of the relationship. We also have a junior affiliate scholar, category, and that's for someone who's not a professor, but is perhaps a postdoc or a PhD candidate. You know, someone who is not established or tenure track. And we have a couple of very exciting junior affiliate scholars who are doing really great work. And then we have a non-residential fellowship category, which everything used to be under. But now today, that's practitioners that we've identified as doing really interesting work and who have proposed a specific project of interest. And so those are people like, Colin Rule, who runs alternative dispute resolution at PayPal, Catherine Crump, who is a lawyer at the ACLU National, who's working on technology and law enforcement, all manner of different people in different kinds of positions, but they're not, strictly speaking, academics. And often this is an opportunity for a practitioner to really have an academic pursuit. I mean, they have access to Stanford, to our events, to the library, and so it's been great for us. And so, yeah, so we have this really great network of affiliates, and if you want to learn more about them, you can go to cyberlaw.stanford.edu and see their bios and see their blog posts as well.
Terrific. Ryan, let's and I'm a, you know, as someone that's been connected with Stanford now for over 5 years, I'm at CIS. I'm very excited to see the work that that you and Tony and Barbara are doing at CIS to give us a real diversity of thought. So I'm biased because I'm affiliated with CIS, but I'll thank you on air for the good work that you're doing, which we can talk about now, at least one part of it. Your article, Boundaries of Privacy Harm. I'll ask this question, which is normally how I start off most interviews. Can you talk a little bit more about your background and how you became interested in privacy issues?
Sure. You know, the truth is that when I was in law school, I actually put together a conference, not on privacy, but on telecommunications. It was about media concentration law, essentially, and we had a bunch of academics and practitioners and others, including Commissioner Adelstein, actually, out to Michigan, and we talked a lot about that. And so when I went into a private practice following my clerkship, I worked at Covington and Burling in D.C., and there I articulated a preference for telecommunications law, which, in fact, I did. But within telecommunications law, I focused on privacy, and I focused on unpacking, for instance, the customer proprietary network information rules at the Federal Communications Commission. And I actually liked it so much that I took on more and more privacy work, to the point that when I left Covington a couple years later, I was doing almost all privacy work. And Covington has a fabulous privacy practice in D.C. that mostly focuses on the Federal Trade and Federal Communications Commission, headed up by Aaron Egan and a couple other folks there. And so I really actually came to get into privacy in 2006 through 2008 in private practice. And then I decided that, you know, there was such a fascinating topic and you could go so deep in certain aspects of it that I really wanted to come to look at it from an academic perspective where I wasn't solving a client's problem or giving advice about a specific set of situations, but backing up a little bit and looking at the greater policy context. And so when I saw an opportunity to be a fellow around consumer privacy at Stanford, I jumped on it.
And with regard to the project itself, are you a one-man band on this, or do students work with you? I'm just curious about the project itself. What support or involvement do you have beyond the people you've already mentioned?
Yeah, so you know it's a growing band of merry travelers, right? So right now, I'm the director. I have a full-time expert on human-computer interaction. She's a PhD in human-computer interaction named Victoria Groom, who is working on we're doing an experiment on how the design of a website affects users' mental models of data flow. That is, how in designing an interface, what effect does that have on what people's expectations are around privacy? I have two research assistants at Stanford Law School, and I also have contributions from people from the CS department over time. And then several of our projects, including the Privacons project I mentioned, actually have external partners. We find that in order to accomplish some of our goals, we need people whose expertise is very specific, and we don't always have it in-house. And then, of course, I also rely on other staff members here at CIS, and so we have a legal assistant, a wonderful legal assistant, Amanda Smith. We have a person working on associate director working on communications and many other aspects of CIS, Elaine Adolfo. And so we have a great team, and there's a lot of opportunity for synergy. I'm sorry, I wouldn't say that in any way that I'm a one man band, although on some projects and in some circumstances, I'm definitely the only person working on it.
Yeah, it was my hyperbolic attempt to discuss more broadly who else is working on these issues. One man band, was a compliment of sorts, I guess, or maybe not. I'm not sure.
We try to do a lot with a little, and it happens that sort of more and more people are getting involved. Another example, by the way, is that we have two affiliates, one of whom is a student fellow, which is a category I forgot to mention. So we have two student fellows, one of whom is working on privacons.org. The other one, Jonathan Mayer, not to be confused with the recording artist, actually is working on Do Not Track with Arvind, who is a junior affiliate scholar. So Do Not Track is this idea that's been getting a lot of press appropriately, right, and a lot of attention from regulators, that we might be able to create a registry like the Do Not Call registry that's been so successful, that permits consumers to opt out of certain kinds of tracking. And the most elegant mechanism, I think, was one that was designed by two affiliates of the Center for Internet and Society. Now, that's not a CIS project per se, but it forms the basis of their affiliation. And I certainly have advised quite a bit on that project. And people interested in it can go to donottrack.us. So do not track us, donottrack.us. And it'd be hard to avoid seeing press coverage of Do Not Track as an idea right now in privacy. So, again, you link up with interesting people. When you have the resources, you hire individuals with expertise that you lack. I think that's the way that we have to proceed.
And we're talking with Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at CIS. Ryan, it's interesting you mentioned this because I've had on the show recently Fred Stutzman, who's a PhD candidate at UNC Chapel Hill, who's authored a couple of apps to shut basically your computer off from the internet for a given period of time so you can get work done. And it's interesting to see these applications more and more that seem to be popping up that cut back your connection with technology as opposed to enhance it for a variety of reasons. It's an interesting trend, perhaps one that I should explore further. But I do want to turn to your article, The Boundaries of Privacy Harm, and have that discussion. The jumping off question really is why write the article, but more specifically, I'll say, why do we need, or why did you perceive a need to define boundaries in what we deem to be violations or harms resulting from violations of privacy?
Right. So that's a great question. I wanted to clarify that actually the article has not come out yet. It's forthcoming in Indiana Law Journal.
Uh-huh. Okay. I thought. So, okay. When is it going to be formally published?
I think given the stage that we're in publication, it should be pretty soon. It should be over the next couple of months. And of course, people can download a previous a draft of it on SSRN if they're interested in taking a look. I just wanted to clarify that.
Sure.
So you won't find it on Westlaw, in other words.
Fair enough.
So why write it? So part of it is just in service of conceptual clarity, but part of it is this notion that privacy harm, instead of helping us focus on what we care about in privacy, privacy harm has actually done the opposite. It's operated as a hurdle. That is, people asking about the privacy space and why it's important have said things like, oh, well, what's the harm? Or courts have required that, harm not only be articulated, but that it be economic or special or actual. And they use all these different words to try to signal that the harm has to be particularly well understood. And then many, many privacy violations go, in essence, unpunished because the harm can't be properly articulated. Also, lots of different concepts are shoehorned into the concept of privacy that perhaps don't belong in that category, in that umbrella category. And in fact, being put into that category ends up diluting the concept of privacy and helping us to avoid what the real value is at stake in some instances. So just to give an example, we talk about contraception and rights to use contraception. We talk about rights to get an abortion. We talk about homosexual sex, all in at a constitutional level in terms of people's the fact that this is a private activity and that it happens within the private sphere. But arguably, at least, and I believe, what's wrong with regulating those activities is that it infringes on liberty. It infringes on autonomy, or else because it only singles out one population, it implicates equality. And when you say, you know, when you treat things like people having sex with who they want to, or using contraception, or having a medical procedure, when you treat those things like you treat obscenity by saying, well, maybe they're real bad, but because they happen in private, we're going to let privacy do the work of protecting it, that ends up doing two things. One, arguably diluting the concept of privacy so that so many things become privacy that we lose sight of it as a concept. And two, allowing us to skirt for now, confronting the real deep values at issue. Now, of course, privacy itself is a real deep value, but maybe not the central value at issue in some of these instances. Also, by the way, if we don't have a very good definition of privacy harm, not only do we not have a limiting principle that allows us to say, no, this is some other kind of harm. It's a harm, and it's an important harm, but it's not a privacy harm. We also don't necessarily have a rule of recognition. That is, when something new happens, some new phenomenon comes up that is, you know, in some ways entirely novel, we're not able to sort of line it up with our definition of privacy harm and say, this is a privacy harm. Rather, we need to sort of think about how it resembles other privacy harms in the past, or see if it's on a particular list. And to my eye, that's very difficult to do because people will disagree. And so I think understanding privacy harm and having a set of boundaries and core principles of privacy harm ends up operating as both a rule of recognition and a limiting principle in ways that are concretely useful.
What is the, you imply it in your answer, but in more detail, what's the current state of privacy law in the United States with regard to these boundaries? I mean, it's not a boundaryless body of law, but where does it stand right now?
Well, you know, I would say that there are really very few overarching boundaries that we can refer to. Maybe reasonable expectation is one, but I mean, just very quickly, in the United States, privacy law is deeply fractured. It tends to be activity or sector specific, such that if there's a particular activity, maybe there's a law that governs it. One example is if you provide a service that rents or sells videos in a variety of contexts, then you have to deal with a particular federal law. Or if you have phone records by virtue of providing a service, there's a different federal law and a federal rules around that. There are specific privacy torts that each have their own elements. And so it really is a patchwork of protections under privacy. And there aren't too many lines delineating what privacy is versus not. I mean, again, reasonable expectation is one that crops up a lot, both in terms of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence and also in terms of tort, where whether you recover or whether something is excluded ends up turning on whether you had a reasonable expectation that someone would get a hold of the data or observe you. And so that's one line. But that's not a boundary around privacy harm. It is a threshold by which you can make use of a particular privacy precedent. And so I would say that there isn't much. I mean, of course, the scholarship is replete with very sophisticated and interesting attempts to figure out what privacy harm is. And there are many wonderful examples from Helen Nissenbaum's work about privacy in context to Dan Solov's work to early definitions by Richard Parker. I mean, there are many, many, many great attempts to define privacy harm in the literature, but they're not generally reflected in the case law or in administrative law.
The kind of the layperson question on this front, of course, would be, well, what about the Constitution? And, you know, we hear, you certainly see in the press, a constant reference whenever any privacy issue comes up to a right to privacy in the Constitution. Do you have a short answer to that issue? In other words, how much, in your view, has the Constitution shaped privacy laws that exist today?
That's an interesting question. I don't know that I have a short answer. I can say that, for instance,
relatively short.
Yeah. So those words don't appear in the Constitution. And if there is a right to privacy in the Constitution, it is because of precedent at the Supreme Court level and other areas that talk about constitutional information privacy or talk about your right to privacy under the Fourth Amendment. It is penumbral, to use a well understood term. So it's not, you know, it's not that the Constitution guarantees you a right to privacy. That would not be accurate. It is that the way that we protect certain constitutional values ends up being through safeguarding privacy, is the best way to say it. However, that's not necessarily the case. So if you look at European directives or you look at certain state constitutions, then you are, in those instances, expressly told you have a right to privacy. Now, whether that, at the end of the day, ends up being practically as opposed to rhetorically significant, I don't know. That is, you know, you could have very robust protections even though you're never told that you have a right to privacy per se. But again, this is something that has developed over time under the common law system.
We're chatting with Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU-FM Stanford. And KZSU-FM is a non-profit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you could make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. You can also go to our newly redesigned webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU and check out the new web design, which I think is an improvement over the previous design. Either way, though, I hope you consider to make a donation and that you keep listening to KZSU. So, Ryan, let's get in a little bit more into the weeds of your article. When we think about this idea of privacy harm, as I mentioned in my introduction, you have identified a split between subjective and objective harms. What are those?
Sure, right. So I think that the range of privacy harms that exist can be captured under two distinct but interrelated components. And the first is a subjective privacy harm. So by subjective, I mean internal to the person that is experienced by the individual. And so these are harms like being uncomfortable because someone is watching you, being embarrassed because someone is observing something that you don't want them to. One example would be, you know, the prisoner who filed a privacy complaint under the rubric of the Eighth Amendment because during urine tests, this prisoner was being observed by a guard. Or another much older classic case is a case where a woman was giving birth and the doctor brought his personal friend along who was not a medical individual just to see it. And the subjective privacy harm is this harm that this woman experienced. And so definitionally it is the experience of unwanted perception, the feeling of unwanted perception. Also, subjective privacy harm is the harm that you experience where you're just concerned that something bad is going to happen to you on account of your data being out there. So, for instance, in the event of a security breach, you know, you may not have actually experienced identity theft, but no one might have actually stolen your credit card. But you're going to be very nervous and upset, and you're going to be anticipating that someone might do that kind of thing. And so, again, this is an internal experience of harm, and it's subjective in that sense. The objective category of privacy harm is the unanticipated or coerced use of information about a person against that person. So these are instances where, well, identity theft is a very obvious example, where your information that's personal, and not in a sense necessarily a personally identifiable, like your name, but basically about you specifically, that in a way that was not anticipated or in a way that's coerced, is used in a way against you, averse to you. Because if it's not averse to you, then I would argue it's really not a harm at all, therefore not a privacy harm. And there are many examples here, but I want to stress that unanticipated and coerced are necessary components. By coerced, I mean, well, let me start with unanticipated. By unanticipated, I mean, you know, you give your email for one purpose, you know, to enter a sweepstakes, and little do you know and little did you expect, that email is going to be sold to thousands and thousands of marketers, and you're going to get a tremendous amount of spam. Therefore, that personal information is the use of it is unanticipated. Or you travel on your browser to get a credit card, and little do you know, the credit card company is looking at where you've been in your history, where you're located in the world by reference to your IP address, what your browser type is, and making a decision about what credit card offer you're going to get on that basis. And sometimes you might get a worse offer, or you might get a different price on the basis of this kind of information. Maybe it's not personally identifiable, but it is specific to you and it's not anticipated. Coerced, however, is there are instances where you know full well how information that's being collected is going to be used, and you just don't want it to be used that way. And one example of that from the paper is a case in which you're pulled over and you have a blood test and to determine whether you've been drinking. And, of course, you know, in that instance, you know exactly how it's going to be used, but, you know, it's coerced. You don't agree to it, and then ultimately it's used against you. So then these are distinct. One is objective in the sense of concrete and actual and external to the individual, and one is subjective. But I think that they're related. They're related, in my view, in the same way that maybe assault and battery are related in tort. So battery is unwanted physical touching, and it can occur whether you know about it or not. That is, you could be sucker punched and experience unwanted touching. Whereas assault is really the apprehension of imminent unwanted physical touching. It is the apprehension of getting hit. And again, it can occur, and it can occur distinctly, even if you don't end up getting hit. So if you just think you're going to get hit, and that's reasonable for you to think that, and it could be quite bad, but it doesn't actually happen. Someone misses, or they don't end up hitting you. You can still have assault. So they're related to one another in the same way. You know, subjective privacy harm is in most instances really about a fear or an uncertainty or an anticipation of some other objective privacy harm. And so really they're two sides of the same very well-worn coin in privacy theory, which is they are the experience and anticipation of a loss of control over information. And so they're not standalone and distinct. They're absolutely two parts of the same machine.
What do you see, Ryan, as the benefit of or benefits of defining privacy harms in these two related ways?
I think there are a number of benefits. So you asked me earlier about what are the benefits of defining privacy harm at all, mm-hmm. and I you know told you what I thought those were. So. You know, and now I understand your question to be, what is the benefit of defining them in these specific ways?
In these specific ways, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's a lot of benefits. You know, one benefit is that you can actually size privacy harms in new ways. And what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes really privacy law is, or even the notion of privacy harm, is really all or nothing, right? Either, you know, one example is the notion of when you're in public, you don't have any reasonable expectation of privacy, right? This is the idea that, you know, if you're in public, like, you know, there's no privacy, I mean, you're implicitly agreeing to it, you're out there in public, and you can't really claim privacy harm. And that's reflected a lot of places in privacy law. But under my interpretation, there's really two levers that you can press on. One lever has to do, so again, on the subjective element, let's look at. So one lever is you know, if it's the experience of unwanted perception, you can put pressure on the degree of how much it's unwanted as distinct from the degree of surveillance, right? So for instance, in my example of the woman who was giving birth, there the extent of the observation was over a relatively short period of time by one person. But the degree of revulsion to that, and to, you know, the degree to, of unwantedness, let's say, was extremely high because it's a very, very personal moment in this woman's life. Contrast that to the notion of being constantly surveilled in a city that has CCTV, closed circuit TV cameras. You know, there, the the unwantedness is not as high. You know, the repulsion is not as high because there is some amount of expectation that people will be able to see you when you go outside, and so you're not doing the same sorts of things. But the degree of surveillance is enormous. And so having two levers to push on, I think, is helpful. Another benefit, I think, is that it allows us to make a credible case that your privacy can be harmed even where nobody ever actually sees the information at issue. No information is even necessarily collected. And so let me give you a couple examples. This is the best told by example. So on the subjective side, and then I'll turn to the objective side. On the subjective side, this is the idea that if the concern is a perception of unwanted observation, that can occur even by mistake, right? So in other words, you could feel uncomfortable because there's a live camera, or you could feel uncomfortable because there's a dummy camera that's actually not collecting any information. You know, that's how the famous or infamous panopticon works, Jeremy Bentham's construction of a prison. It relies on the notion not that you're actually constantly being observed, but you constantly perceive that you're being observed. And the power of the panopticon, the reason it's an amplifying architectural design, is because all of the prisoners don't know exactly when the guard is looking at them, if at all. And so, you know, today there is this sort of very strong minority in the scholarship, and I would say probably a majority in the actual precedent and law, that tends to look at if there's no actual collection taking place, perhaps there's no privacy harm. And what I want to argue is that that's not the case. In fact, I argue in a previous article that even when you're mistaken about that there's a person present, the fact that you perceive that there is actually can end up doing the same things. And so, for instance, there are many, many studies that show that we're hardwired to react to anthropomorphic technologies, social interfaces and things like that, you know, eyes, faces, voices, as though a person were really there. Physiologically and behaviorally, we act often the same. So, for instance, people will pay for coffee more often on the honor system when there is a picture of eyes over the collection plates for coffee than when there's a picture of flowers. And there are many, 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 many examples of this. As you likely know, more and more our technology is becoming social. You know, we have GPS devices with voices. We have interfaces and phone systems that talk to us. We have a lot of voice control technology in the home. You know, personal robots eventually will become something that are more common. And all these technologies, even if they don't end up actually collecting information, might still implicate values and privacy we care about. They might, for instance, interrupt solitude. You'll never get those moments off stage that Weston talks about. You'll never escape from a state of psychological arousal because all the time your brain will feel as though a person were really present. So I'm trying to capture this entire range of interesting subjective privacy harms, some of which have nothing to do with collection. And then if you'll permit me just to make the same argument on the objective side.
Sure.
On the objective side, again, nobody actually has to see information for it to be used against you. And that seems like it ought to be more apparent, but quite a few people argue against this idea. So the notion is that if you look at, say, Richard Posner's views on surveillance and on monitoring, and he says, look, you know, most of the sifting through all the data mining that occurs, most of the sifting through your emails or your transactions or your phone conversations isn't even done by an official, right? It's done by a computer program. And it only ever tells an official if it sees something suspicious. And so if anything, it's privacy enhancing because officials only see information when it becomes relevant. But of course, machines are perfectly capable of acting against your interests without a human being ever being in the loop. And one example is, for instance, and this I owe this to Danielle Citrin's work, the no-fly list. Mm-hmm. Combs through a bunch of different data, combs through a bunch of different databases and coughs up that you shouldn't be allowed to travel. It doesn't matter whether a human being actually ever sees the information that underlies that decision. It happens automatically. Another example, maybe to drive this home, is a hypothetical from the paper. But imagine that there's a psychologist and law enforcement comes to the psychologist and says, hey, you know, give me all of your patient notes. And the psychologist says, what are you nuts? No way I'm going to do that. Right? This is extremely private information and it's protected by privacy and another law. I mean, I'm not going to give you my notes. And the official says, oh, no, don't worry. We're not actually going to read it. We're going to feed it into a machine. And every time we see a reference to someone smoking marijuana or doing something else illegal, we're going to automatically generate a ticket and send it to them. But we'll never actually see the underlying information. That's, of course, absurd. And the reason it's absurd is because, again, computers and other technologies are perfectly able to violate your privacy and to harm you from a privacy perspective without a human being ever really being in the loop. And so, again, you know, in addition to sort of clarifying and permitting additional sizing and doing some other things, I also believe that my work on privacy harm captures convincingly captures some kinds of privacy harms that don't involve either the collection of information at all, or at least don't involve a human being in the loop, if that makes sense.
It does, and we're chatting with Ryan Kahlo of the Center for Internet Society at Stanford. Now, Ryan, you've covered a lot of ground there in that answer. We have about 10 minutes left at this point. And what I want to follow up on one point there before we turn towards some future projects the CIS has. And so you covered several questions that I was going to ask there, which is a good thing. Let me follow up with this, though. With regard to the kinds of harms where one perceives a observation, and that being harmful, or, you know, perhaps the automated decision-making issues that you've raised, can or does the law cognize that? In other words, how does the law deal with a harm based upon the perception of observation?
It varies tremendously. So for instance, even within Supreme Court precedent about observation and whether it can interfere with First Amendment rights, you see completely different answers if you look at say the Keith case versus Laird. So in some instances, the Supreme Court said, I understand that the government is engaged in systematic observation, and that's, you know, unfortunate. But, you know, it doesn't rise to the level of actually chilling your behavior. Whereas in other instances, the Supreme Court and other courts have said, an excessive amount of observation can actually implicate your right to associate and your right to speak, because if you feel like you're constantly being scrutinized, then you don't feel as free. On the side of automated decision making, there's a lot of precedent, surprising amount of precedent, that suggests that you have absolutely no, you don't have any right, you don't have any protection from contraband. With respect to contraband. So in other words, it's okay for dogs to sniff your luggage, or it's not a Fourth Amendment search for dogs to sniff your luggage, because they only alert, the reasoning is, when you have, you know, cocaine or drugs or bombs, and no person's actually seeing, you know, what is in your bag. And, you know, so there's a number of different cases that suggest that as long as a person isn't seeing the content that's in the area being searched, and as long as it only ever comes into play once you've already detected contraband. Another example is in a Terry stop with a pat down. If the officer is patting you down for their safety and they feel something in your pocket, then quote, in their experience as an officer, turns out to be a paraphernalia, then they can grab it. And again, the reasoning is the same, which is that they've already detected it and it's contraband and you have no reasonable expectation there. But writ large, if you think about that writ large, you know, that would mean that you might be able to do some of the kind of dragnet kind of surveillance that seems to be occurring already in the United States, and that Larry Lessig wrote about in Code, which he dramatized with the example of a worm that just searches through all of your information and only ever alerts if there's child pornography. So if anything, I think that the law really does actually support for now. And there are people, you know, who disagree with this. There are plenty of people who write that this current is not as strong as I'm making it out to be. I'm sorry. So to back up to answer your question more concretely, in some instances, you do see the mere perception, the mere feeling of perception as being harmful. And in other instances, you definitely see this notion that if no person sees it, it's not a harm, reflected in the literature. In both the literature and in precedent. One other point is, in other areas of the law, much more concretely, you get these subjective harms play out. So, for instance, you know, there are cases in environmental and pollution area where, for instance, you know, you could have a factory that causes fumes to waft onto your property, and you get really, really concerned about it. And those fumes can be like greenish and scary, and they can be tested to be found to be completely innocuous. And yet, just because they scare you and are on your property, you end up being able to recover. There are other instances in other areas of the law where subjective harm is definitely compensated. Assault, again, is another example in tort. So it's not necessarily the case, but it turns out to be mostly the case that you don't actually see it compensated enough.
We're chatting with Brian Kahlo of Stanford CIS on Hearsay Culture FM Stanford. Ryan, with the last 5 minutes we have, I want to ask one last question regarding your paper, and then quickly talk about some upcoming CIS projects. With regard to this area of law, you said something in that answer. You said for now the law exists this way. I don't ask people to bring out their crystal ball, but I'll ask you merely if there's a trend. What trend do you see having developed over the last year or two, especially as you mentioned, Facebook and others have come under very sharp and public criticism for their privacy standards, and so I think privacy and the concept of privacy has entered more people's minds from a technological standpoint than ever before. Is there a trend that you see developing that would suggest that the kinds of harms that you've defined here are going to be afforded more or less protection over the next couple of years?
I think the levee is going to break, and we're going to see a lot more protection. Right. I mean, I think that with the introduction of cameras and the domestic use, for instance, of drones in law enforcement at the border and in our cities, lots of other things, eventually the levee is going to break and people are going to realize that this idea that you have no expectation of privacy in public is going to have to collapse on its own weight. In the consumer privacy space, you see signals from the Federal Trade Commission saying that, look, the paradigm we have so far where companies can do what they want, essentially, as long as they put it in some privacy policy that they're doing it in general terms, you also see that beginning to collapse on its own weight. And you see these competing visions out of the Department of Commerce and the Federal Trade Commission about whether we should be moving toward a sort of more European novel that's grounded in a model that's grounded in dignity. I think the levee is going to break, and we're going to see these kinds of harms specifically protected because it's going to be absurd not to at some point. I wish I could tell you to a bunch. I mean, I can point to a couple of consumer privacy precedents, you know, the Sears case the Sears complaint and consent decree and the FTC starts to signal a shift towards more substantive regulation there as opposed to a notice and choice regime. But you know, a lot of the precedent continues to move in the other direction.
Ryan, in the last couple of minutes that we have, and this has been a fascinating conversation, I commend the listeners to this article because I do think that it helps us think about privacy today in ways that are significantly more productive than the broad phrases that we use and have used to now. What's coming up at CIS? You have a couple of interesting projects. Perhaps you could, in the three or so minutes that we have left, talk about what they are, what we can look forward to coming out of CIS.
Sure. I mentioned privacy policies and how they're not a very effective way to convey notice to users about what's going on the Internet. One of the big problems with Internet privacy is that you're constantly being tracked, but it doesn't feel like you are. So we're actually doing an experimental study on how the design of a website affects people's mental models of that website. That is, affects what people understand to be going on in terms of information collection and use. And so we'll be able to eventually release the results of that study. And then in areas having nothing to do with privacy, we're actually beginning to look at other really interesting developing emerging technologies, one of which is robotics and specifically autonomous vehicles. And so we're starting a really serious project devoted specifically to the legal and policy aspects of autonomous driving, and that's in affiliation with the engineering school here at Stanford, the Center for Automotive Research at Stanford. Now I don't want to take up too much time, but there's a lot of interesting, exciting things to look out for in the future here.
And you mentioned it at the beginning, but I'll mention it again. So for people that want to learn more about CIS and your work, where can they go?
Well, they can go to cyberlaw.stanford.edu, and that's our blog and our site. If your listeners are interested in privacy or robotics, I think that maybe the most efficient thing to do would be to follow me on Twitter, as that's what I write about there, and I'm RCALO, so twitter.com/RCALO, and you can also follow Stanford CIS on Twitter as well. And also be on the lookout for changing our website to some degree to make it easier to navigate. I heard you mention that earlier, Dave, and I think we're going to be doing some of that too. So look out for a new CIS website as well.
Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford CIS, and a colleague. Ryan, thanks for joining us today on Hearsay Culture and updating us on CIS and talking about your really groundbreaking and interesting work. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Me too. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up this quarter. I'm excited about the list in no particular order yet because I'm still putting the schedule together. And I should mention that this show is being recorded on January 11th for airing January 12th. I can say that next week, Sarah Rose, the author of the book For All the Tea in China, will be on. And then rounding out the rest of the quarter, again, I expect and will have the schedule up for the quarter within the next week. I'm looking forward to chatting with Associate Dean Mike Madison of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Evgeny Morozov, a foreign policy author of the book How Dictators Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Web, Professor Jennifer Urban, the director of the Samuelson Law, Technology, and Public Policy Clinic at Berkeley, Professor David Post of Temple University, author of In Search of Jefferson's Moose, Notes on the State of Cyberspace, Professor Dan Hunter of New York Law School, Jamay Cassio, discussing his book Hacking the Earth, Professor Andy Hiley of Elon, my colleague here at Elon, discussing online sales taxation, Professor Ramesh Srinivasan of the Department of Information Studies and Design at the University of California, Los Angeles. Kevin Paulson of Wired, author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 Billion Cybercrime Underground. Professor John Turanian of Chapman University School of Law, author of Infringement Nation. And then several guests that will be coming down the road, people I anticipate interviewing over the summer. include Dan Soliv, also another very prolific and influential privacy scholar of George Washington University School of Law, author of forthcoming book Nothing to Hide, The False Trade-Off Between Privacy and Security. Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine will be on discussing his book What Technology Wants. Adam Pennenberg of New York University, author of Viral Loop from Facebook to Twitter, How Today's Smartest Businesses Grow Themselves. Pamela Long, author of Obelisk, a History. I like to have historians on from time to time. Certainly Sarah Rose's book, For All the Tea in China, is a really interesting story of the theft of trade secrets, particularly tea itself. And Pamela's book is an interesting study, similarly, of scientific principles. And that is our list so far. Lastly, Siva V.D. Nathan of the University of Virginia will be on discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything. As always, there are a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. The best way is to listen live on KZSU Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific Time, and you can get the show there live. Or you can get it by podcast. Several ways. You can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous 130 or so shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. You can pick up the show by going to Stanford's webpage, which Ryan mentioned, that I mention on every show, cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And you can also go to Stanford CIS's iTunes page, where you can subscribe to the show as well. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So I'm excited to starting off another quarter. I hope you've enjoyed today's conversation with Ryan Kahlo. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.